I got to thinking about that tree falling in a forest with nobody around thing today and whether it makes a noise. And somehow I got to this. If you start a trade war in an absolutely chaotic news environment, is anybody going to notice? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday today, June the 22nd. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We're going to get right to it because why dilly-dally, right? 5 days in this economy, 5 minutes of live radio. Catherine Rempel's with The Washington Post. Dion Rabone is with Yahoo Finance. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me set the scene here. The European Union's tariffs, retaliatory tariffs, on three-something billion dollars worth of American goods went into effect today. The president then later this morning tweeted out, you know what, if the Europeans don't cut it out, we're going to tariff cars at 20%. And so my question is, we're getting serious now, yeah?
I would argue it's been serious for a while, given that Trump has taken pretty extreme actions to alienate many of our military allies and trading partners, whose support he needs to keep China in check, which has actually been the bad actor here. The EU and Canada and others have not. But, yeah, I mean, certainly these are not good developments in the trade war or trade wars or skirmishes or whatever whatever noun we are now using to characterize all of this.
Well, so, Dion, to my somewhat metaphysical question with which I started the program today, I mean, people are noticing, but are they, I guess, are they paying attention, right? Because there's so much else going on, and honestly, it gets a bit numbing, not only the other news, but the tariff news as well, because who can keep track?
Well, certainly people are going to pay attention when this starts to hit their wallets. I mean, Harley-Davidson, one of the companies that the EU threatened to put tariffs on from the U.S., actually just laid off 200 workers today in Kansas City. When these, you know, when these tariffs actually do hit and start to hit people's wallets, which most certainly you expect they will, we're definitely going to get people paying attention. It's also important to note that Trump is being a bit disingenuous when he talks about free trade. The U.S. doesn't have as many tariff barriers, but we also subsidize a number of our industries, particularly agriculture, and that leads to, you know, what Trump would call unfair trade practices by the U.S. So while, you know, it's not all tariffs, but it's not all fair. And so if we're going to reduce tariffs and demand these other countries to reduce tariffs, maybe we ought to reduce some of our subsidies, which I really think Trump would not be in favor of doing because that would kill him in the heartland.
Right, right. And that's the domestic policy part of this. Catherine, I'm going to steal from what's going to come up in the program in about 5 or 6 minutes, which is a little listener question and answer we're going to do. But one of the questions is, what's the marker of success? How is the Trump administration going to define success? And we'll hear my take on it in a bit. What's your sense of how the Trump administration would say, you know what, we won. We're good with this trade war.
I think Trump himself is personally obsessed with trade deficits. Mm-hmm. He wants to reduce the deficit, which is the wrong way to be thinking about. Well, first of all, winning and losing is not exactly right. The framework I would use, but that's not the way to be looking at markers of success at the very least. You know, what we should be working on, again, is trying to get China in line in the areas where it actually is behaving badly, which is not reflected in the trade deficit so much as its intellectual property protections or lack thereof, forced technology transfer. Those are the things that we should be working toward. Those are not really the things Trump is paying attention to. You know, if you listen to what he's saying, he's obsessed with a deficit.
Right. And also, Dion, just on the issue of getting China to do what you want, there is this coalition of the willing that we had that we left called Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP.
Yeah, that would have been nice to have right now, wouldn't it? Yeah. 11 countries on our side pushing against China. Also, the EU is a nice, strong economic bloc that would have been great to put some force pressure on China. It doesn't look like they're going to be in line to do that right now. So, again, it's interesting when you talk about, you know, your friends and your enemies. The whole point of having friends is that you can all get together and focus on a common enemy. Trump is kind of making himself the enemy or the U.S. the enemy when it comes to economic policy.
So here comes kind of another metaphysical question then, Catherine, and the due caveat has to be given, as I do every time, the stock market is not the economy and the economy is not the stock market. But with global trade tensions undeniably tightening, why aren't global markets going belly up?
Well, we have seen markets have at least temporary, degrees of panic, including this week over tariff policy. The question is, Trump is so fickle. Like, what does he actually plan to do? So you may recall that I think 3 months ago he said that he was going to announce another $100 billion of tariffs or something like that on China, and he never actually came up with that list. More recently, he said it was $200 billion of additional tariffs on China, and that's what markets responded to this week. But is that going to materialize? Who knows? I mean, he might get distracted by some other shiny object, or the other people in his administration who are more pro-free trade may win out and rein him in. But I think that's really what it's about. Markets are trying to gauge how serious he actually is about any of this. And some things are very troubling, particularly the tariffs that have already been implemented. But some things may be an empty threat.
Quickly, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think currency traders, bond traders, emerging market traders would disagree with you when you say, why aren't the markets going belly up? Some folks in Argentina have seen their markets really go belly up. And so, you know, when you ask where it is, China's stock market was down for 11 days straight. Markets are certainly reacting.
Dionne Rabone at Yahoo Finance, Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post, both of them from our studios in New York today. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks for having us, Guy.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, really, it was one of those trade war, what trade war kind of days. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right. So as Catherine and Dionne and I were talking about the headline economic news this week and for the past couple of weeks, really, and who knows, maybe the next couple of weeks as well, has been tariffs. Europe's kicked in today. Canada's start on July 1st. China is on the 6th. So we are going to take a little time today and answer some more of your questions. The best way to get them to us is on Twitter. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. The shop itself is at Marketplace. And we begin with an item that is on pretty much all the retaliatory tariff lists. The question comes to us from Chad Cross in Atlanta, Georgia.
If countries impose tariffs on U.S. goods such as bourbon, does that mean the domestic market for bourbon could see excess supply? Asking for a friend.
Bourbon, of course, from Kentucky. We got Colleen Thomas on the phone. She is with the Kentucky Distillers Association. That is everybody from the big bourbon icons to small craft distilleries. And she says, in essence, they're still trying to figure it out.
Bourbon has to be aged. So our bourbon producers forecast 4, 6, 8, 12 years out. So we're producing for the future demand based on the growing demand that we've been experiencing. So if that demand drops, then we will have a surplus of product here.
So the answer, Chad, for your friend, of course, is yes, excess bourbon supply. Darian Mason out of San Antonio, Texas had this one.
Who has the power to impose tariffs and where does this power come from?
Mary Lovely is an economics professor at Syracuse University, also a fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
So in this case, the ultimate power comes from Congress. It's been delegated to the president.
However, comma.
What that also means is that the Congress could take that power back. And we have seen some moves in Congress to try to get movement in that direction because there are some folks who worry about the effect of these tariffs on U.S. businesses.
From Trumbull, Connecticut, Stephanie Grubler has a bottom line kind of question.
I'm a single mom. I live paycheck to paycheck. Is this going to affect my gas fill-ups, oil heat to my home, groceries, or is this a durable goods thing?
The short answer is yes, kind of. The longer answer from Katie Russ, she's an associate professor of economics at UC Davis, also a former Obama White House economist, is that it's tricky to calculate exactly how these tariffs are going to filter through the economy as they stand right now. So she ran some numbers on how much it would cost consumers if we were in an all-out trade war. That's 25% tariffs on everything coming in.
If there's an all-out trade war, then you could probably expect to see your food bill increase by between $100 and $300 a year, depending on your income bracket. So that's for incomes between $15,000 and $150,000 a year.
We got a couple of people asking about other times the trade tensions have been this high. And, oh, by the way, what happened then? For this one, we called up Wendy Cutler. She's the vice president of the Asia Society Policy Institute. Once upon a time, the acting deputy trade representative in the Obama administration.
So probably the most tense time in trade history was in the lead up to the Great Depression. And in 1930, Congress passed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, and that put into place U.S. tariffs on tens of thousands of products and basically closed our market. Others followed.
Anyone? Anyone? Holly Smoot? Anyone? We should be clear here, that is absolutely not where we are closing the markets. But it does get to our last question from Twitter user Ivan the K in New York City. Here you go.
How does the Trump administration define success in executing this trade policy?
So I'm going to echo Catherine here a little bit. You can piece together an answer from what the White House and others have said publicly. Some combination of lower trade deficits, the president's favorite, if flawed indicator. Also an end to unfair trade practices as the White House sees them. It's the getting there that's making the whole global economy a little bit uptight, though. Mexico's presidential election is in a bit more than a week, next Sunday, July the 1st. Among those watching closely are American energy companies that have been working in Mexico since that country overhauled its energy sector back in 2014. The change let foreign power companies do business down there for the first time since 1938. And the front runner in the campaign, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, says new rules haven't done what they were supposed to do: lower prices for gas and electricity. And he wants to add back some state regulation of the energy industry, which could jeopardize billions of dollars in current and planned foreign investment in oil and natural gas and wind and solar as well. Lauren Madelon has that story from Mexico City.
Antonio Godinez Vera slides kernels of corn into a grinder where they're turned into a mash that becomes tortillas. People like Godinez, a small business owner with four employees, are part of a populist wave that could power López Obrador, a left-leaning candidate to the Mexican presidency. The country hasn't gained a thing, Godinez says, about Mexico's energy reform. Blackouts are common, and though reformers promise to narrow the gap between energy costs in the U.S. and Mexico, energy analysts estimate he pays about 20% more for his electricity than a business does in the U.S. Add to that escalating violence and accusations of corruption against the current government. Godinez says he's backing López Obrador.
Salir de la miseria.
To escape what Godinez calls our misery. At rallies, López Obrador takes on both Mexico's political class and foreign energy contracts.
Lo que creció fue la desigualdad, fue la inseguridad y la violencia.
All that's grown is inequality, insecurity, and violence, he says. Mexico's energy reform is also a favorite target.
Así de claro, ya no se va a seguir con la política privatizadora.
We will end privatization of energy, he declares. López Obrador then calls the government, with its overtures to outside energy interests, a mafia of power.
Sí, esa mafia que tiene el control.
Words like that make many energy companies nervous in places like Veracruz in southern Mexico, where much of the country's energy is either produced or refined.
If they start to reviewing everything, we are going to slow down, put more regulation, put more roadblocks.
That's Ignacio Quesada. He's on the board of International Frontier Resources, one of the first foreign energy companies to be awarded a drilling contract in Veracruz after Mexico opened the doors to its energy sector 4 years ago.
If we're moving at 10 kilometers, we should be moving at 60. But no, these guys are thinking of moving at 2. We're going the wrong direction in terms of simplifying the process.
Much of the drilling expertise that Mexico uses was perfected in the oil and gas-rich Permian Basin of Texas. Kirk Edwards, CEO of Latigo Petroleum in Odessa, Texas, says U.S. energy companies considering Mexico are waiting before they commit millions of dollars.
And nobody's going to start doing some of that today without the certainty of what may happen in the future.
Something else is in play in this year's presidential campaign. Tony Payan directs the Mexico Center at Rice University in Houston.
President Trump is a central character in the Mexican election.
Payan says Trump's anti-Mexico rhetoric has lifted López Obrador's ardently nationalist campaign. So Payan says U.S. energy companies need to be ready if he wins.
The rules of the game are definitely going to change.
The Mexican government has said foreign energy companies would ultimately contribute $200 billion to the country's economy. But so far, López Obrador says it's only those businesses and not the people who are seeing the benefits of that investment. In Mexico City, I'm Lorne Madelon for Marketplace.
Coming up.
LA loves street vendors, but unfortunately the laws have not.
Street vending, trying to get street legal. But first, let's do the numbers. After eight down days, Dow Industrial's up 0.4% today, 119 points, 24,580. S&P 500 picked up 0.1%, 5 points, 2754. The NASDAQ down 0.2%, 20 points, 76 and 92. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow was up 2%, the S&P 500 0.9%, NASDAQ 0.7%. European automakers, as you might imagine, retreated after those threatened tariffs from the president. Daimler down 0.3% overseas. BMW dropped more than 1.1%. Harley-Davidson had a problem, too. Dion was talking about that. Iconic Milwaukee-based motorcycle companies warned tariffs could have a significant impact on sales, down 0.2%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. Just as you count on Marketplace for fact-based, unbiased news and information, we are counting on listeners like you to invest in what we do. And right now, your donation in any amount could unlock a $25,000 challenge from Candida if we meet our goal of 6,000 Marketplace investors this fiscal year. So please support public service journalism today at Marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We were going around the horn at our news meeting this morning when our foreign editor, John Buckley, he said this.
This weekend's the second anniversary of the Brexit vote. It was the 23rd of June, 2016.
Which made me sit up and say, wait, what? Turns out tomorrow is 2 years since the Brits voted themselves out of the European Union. 2 years of negotiating things like a customs union, who can work where, and basically what the entire economic future of the UK is going to look like. And now the actual exit part of Brexit is less than a year away, March next year. And there are signs that businesses are starting to get some serious cold feet about what's to come. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
Right after the Brexit vote, a lot of economists were predicting bad times ahead for Britain as it moved to leave the European Union's duty-free customs union and single market for trade. Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute was among them, but looking back, he says,
many of the most dire predictions of a very significant recession were proven wrong. UK consumers didn't become more risk-averse and stop spending.
But now, 2 years on, with the Conservative government still some way from an orderly separation with the EU, the economy is starting to suffer, Kierkegaard says.
Driven by a very significant decrease in business investment.
Growth in Britain, at just 0.1% last quarter, is among the slowest in the advanced industrial nations. Major manufacturers are threatening to move production out. Job growth has slowed. And Charles Kupchan at the Council on Foreign Relations predicts post-Brexit London will lose clout as a financial center.
UBS, Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, JP Morgan have said that they're either relocating lots of jobs or maybe they could leave the UK. The picture is really quite dire.
I put it to him, weren't previous dire economic warnings overblown? Kupchan says yes, but
keep in mind that Britain is still in the EU. Trade is still crossing the channel in an unfettered way.
He predicts a growing crisis across the economy as the March 2019 exit date gets closer and businesses in Britain get a clearer sense of just how much disruption a hard break with Europe will cause. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The biggest movie theater chain in the country, AMC, is trying something a little bit different. Subscriptions. The company announced this week it's kicking off the summer movie season with what it's branding as the AMC Stubs A-List. $20 a month gets you 3 movies a week. That's double the cost of competitor Movie Pass with fewer trips to the theater. But it might be the wave of the future. Marketplace's Renata Sago takes a look at how one more subscription service could change how theaters and the studios are making their money.
Vivi Tran goes to the movie theater about 4 times a month to see new releases. Sometimes she uses her MoviePass subscription, but that requires advanced planning, scheduling, and movie availability. So on busier, big opening weekends, she pays at the box office.
There are movies that people really like hype up. So I'm like, oh, I gotta see it. And I think it'll be a fun crowd.
Movies brought in $11 billion at the box office last year. Tom Noonan, who's a lecturer at the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television, says generally the studios that crank out the films get 50% of box office sales.
And the theater owner gets the other 50%.
That percentage can change from film to film to make sure that studios recoup the money they spend on production and marketing. But Noonan says with discounted tickets and a subscription service,
all of that's coming out of the exhibitor, meaning AMC's pocket, their share. It doesn't affect the studios or the movies that are being shown there.
Analyst Paul DeGarabedian is with Comscore, which tracks box office receipts. He says it's too early to know just how AMC's new subscription service will affect overall revenue. But he says the chain's betting on filling more seats and turning a profit on concessions.
If they have people going into their theater more often, that's more popcorn, drinks, you know, red vines that are being sold.
But will the passes be enough to keep people coming back to the theater? The real threat are the studios who could be moving toward their own streaming platforms. I'm Renata Sego for Marketplace.
There are a lot of things that make Los Angeles special. Being able to buy street food legally is not one of them. This is the only major American city where street vending is against the law. For now. Anyway, the city council has approved what it calls a framework for overturning the longtime ban on sidewalk sales here. An actual ordinance legalizing it is expected to be on the books by the end of the summer. But regulating capitalism is never easy because one person's street vending cart is another person's brick-and-mortar shop competition. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has this one.
On a recent afternoon in L.A.'s wholesale district, Ashley Roberts is crouched beside a sidewalk display of clothes, DVDs, and phone accessories. What she's doing is illegal, but Roberts says getting a good spot can mean making enough money to eat that day.
It all depends on what area you set up at, whether the cops are going to bug with you.
Roberts has already received two citations in the few months she's been doing this. Vendors also face fines and in the past even arrest. Then there's negotiating with businesses, like the sunglass wholesaler Roberts is parked in front of.
They don't mind, as long as you're not blocking the sidewalk or, you know, taking their customers.
It's not just traditional brick-and-mortar shops that clash with street vendors. Over on Hollywood's Walk of Fame, Gulay Karan is paying $5,000 a month in rent for her hat kiosk. It's prime real estate, filled with thousands of tourists. She says the nearby street vendors are unsightly.
We don't want them here, that's for sure. As you can see, they put a lot of table and then they get lots of attention. It's not fair.
Despite the fear of fines, having to constantly relocate, and other hassles that come with street vending, for many, it's worth it. There are about 50,000 vendors operating on LA's streets in a given year. Vendors here earn an average of $10,000 annually. Rudy Espinoza is with the L.A. Street Vending Campaign, which recently stepped up its efforts to legalize these workers.
It really only caught momentum when, in 2016, we elected a new president.
As soon as President Trump took office, Los Angeles officials decriminalized street vending. No more misdemeanors, just citations and fines. That's because under the administration's new immigration enforcement priorities, a street vending charge could get somebody deported. Espinoza says most of the city's street vendors are immigrants, many undocumented.
We shouldn't be looking to criminalize or exclude these folks. These are hardworking people that say, I don't want a handout, I just want an opportunity.
Under the proposed ordinance, LA will require vendors to get permits, pay taxes, and follow new regulations. Business groups lobbied hard for property owners to have the right to veto street vending outside their doors. Espinoza's glad the city rejected that.
We thought that that was wrong, and it was cutting out vending. We thought it was going to open the door for exploitation.
Instead, business owners would be notified when vendors seek permits near their doors, and they'd have a chance to lodge an appeal. Doug Smith is an attorney with civil rights law firm Public Counsel. He says a permit system is the best way to make legal what's already out in the open.
LA loves street vendors, but unfortunately the laws have not. And banning the activity, it's had this effect of forcing the entire sector into the unregulated and informal economy.
Others worry strict permitting and regulation could be too costly for low-income entrepreneurs with few resources. Cal Poly Pomona professor Alvaro Huerta is an expert on the informal economy.
Now, we want them to be engaged in activities such as selling tamales and paletas and things like that. Those that are outside of that permitting process, you're pushing them further and further into the margins.
Huerta imagines a two-tier system emerging, those with permits and those without. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, a bit more on the global nature of the car industry, which I will set up by asking this question. How American-made does a car have to be an American-made car? right? I know. But the good people at Cars.com have an answer. They do an American-made index every year, a top 10 list of the cars with the most domestic parts in them. 72% is the answer to the question. The 2018 Jeep Cherokee at the top of the list has 72% domestic parts in it. I don't know about the other 28. All right, we got to go. Up for a change on Wall Street. Dow Industrials up 0.4% today. S&P 500 gained a tenth. NASDAQ down 0.2%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.